First case of the morning, Ms. Chavez versus Credit Nation. And Ms. Weiss, we'll be pleased to hear from you.
May it please the court. Summary judgment was improperly granted in this case for three reasons. The district court did not consider circumstantial evidence on the mixed motive case as taught by the Supreme Court in the Desert Palace case. They also ignored direct evidence and pretext evidence and made findings of fact. There is a great deal of circumstantial evidence showing inference of discrimination in this case, and Credit Nation did not show uncontroverted evidence in favor of its rationale. They did not sustain their burden of showing that they would have fired her anyway. Credit Nation's case is that Ms. Chavez transitioned. We were very supportive. Then we find that she's a thief. She was sleeping. And we fired her and ignore the rest. But Magistrate Clay and Judge Duffy both found prima facie case and an inference of discrimination. And the burden is on the defendant to show that they would have fired her anyway, and they admitted that they have no zero-tolerance policy for sleeping.
Well, let's talk about the framework that the court should use to evaluate the case, that the district court should have used to evaluate the case. We have a sort of a, this is a circumstantial case, right?
Well, but we have shown both direct and circumstantial.
I don't know that the direct evidence is enough, so I wouldn't waste all my time arguing that you have direct evidence, but we've got, this is a circumstantial case, and it's your contention that that we ought to apply a mixed, we ought to apply McDonnell Douglas in the mixed motive context? Is that your argument?
Yes. And we should not apply McDonnell Douglas in the mixed motive context. You just said that.
What framework should we use to evaluate the evidence?
You should use the statutory framework, which is if there is any motivating bias, then that is the establishment of a mixed motive case, and certainly at summary judgment, the jury should get it.
So we modify McDonnell Douglas at the third stage.
I think you say we discard McDonnell Douglas. We don't look at legitimate reason and pretext. We just discard all of that and go to something else? Is that what you want us to do?
Yes. We discard the pretext because essentially in a mixed motive case, the reason is conceded. That's what a mixed motive case is. Somebody did something wrong, and there's another motivating factor. And so there's lots of circumstantial evidence of that motivating factor.
All right. So I'm clear then. We don't first determine whether or not the plaintiff has established a prima facie case and then shift the burden of the defendant to articulate a legitimate non-discriminatory reason. We go straight to mixed motive?
You go straight to mixed motive. And that's what the Sixth Circuit has said, as well as a number of other courts, five of the six circuits that have considered
it. And we've consistently avoided the issue and said we don't have to. Is that kind of what we've done?
I think so far. And, concededly, this issue is something that requires some thought. But I think that the way the Sixth Circuit understood it is the correct way, because if you acknowledge the legitimate rationale, then what is the point of trying to talk about pretext? It's admitted. The question is there another motivating bias? And, you know, in this case,
here's what I thought other circuits were doing, and I could be dead wrong, so I know
I'm sorry.
Here's what I thought other circuits were doing. They were still looking at whether there was a legitimate articulated reason, and which we have here. Doesn't mean it's the real reason, but they articulated something, the sleeping on the job. And then I thought mixed motive, you go and look at kind of pretext, but it doesn't have to be as strong of a burden that they would normally have or that you would normally have. If you show there were two motives, you could get a fact issue on pretext, or the proxy would be mixed motive.
That's
it,
not.
Is that kind of what we do, or do we really totally discard McDonnell Douglas? I know you argue we discard it, but I thought we kind of kept a little bit of it, and then on pretext, we look at mixed motive.
Well, that's not what the other courts have done that we've cited.
Okay.
When you look at the Fourth, the Fifth, Sixth, the Ninth Circuit, and the D.C. Circuit, what they've essentially done is they've said, this is a situation where the question of discriminatory motive is inherent in 2000E-2M. So it's okay. Different from a but-for case.
All right.
In which case it would make a lot of sense to do it as you suggested, Your Honor. In this case, we're just admitting the issue. We're admitting or conceding for purposes of the mixed motive case that was the reason. So we don't need to analyze pretext.
Okay, so all you do is you're conceding there was an articulated legitimate reason, and you just go to mixed motive.
Correct, and you have to look at, do we have direct evidence of that motivation? If not, then we look at the circumstances.
We don't call it pretext. We just call it mixed motive.
Correct, because in the pretext case, what you've got to do with that circumstantial evidence is get the ball all the way across the line and show that it didn't happen. They did not fire her for being a thief or sleeping or the combination thereof, whatever it might be. That had nothing to do with it. But on our mixed motive case, all we have to show is, okay, fine, that's the reason they put down. Let's take that as a given. Are there enough circumstances to show? And we have tremendous number of circumstances here. This is not the typical case of some ambiguous statements by a non-decision maker. For a year and a half, she's a great mechanic.
Let me understand this now. So your argument is that the district court applied the wrong framework by applying the McDonnell Douglas framework, so therefore we should remand back for a different framework.
Correct.
Okay, all right.
For a year and a half, she was a great mechanic, best in the shop, and then within 45 days, the decision maker, Mr. Torsha, says she's a problem employee, and then an undignified exit out the door. She's a thief, she's sleeping on the job.
So under the correct framework, the employer could fire her for sleeping on the job as long as transgender discrimination was not a motivating factor?
That's correct.
Okay.
Once it's a motivating factor.
And your position is it doesn't have to be the predominant motivating factor. It just can be any factor at all. Or is it that it's got to be the predominant motivating factor?
The statute says a motivating factor.
Okay, but what do the cases say that you've been talking about when they go to apply mixed motive? What do they say?
They say a motivating factor.
Okay, so it's a yes. Motivating factor.
Correct.
Isn't there a potential for abuse there? Let's assume the employer or supervisor on the job makes some statements that can be translated as discriminatory. And exhibits, discrimination against transgender people. What's to stop the employee under that circumstance from having carte blanche thereafter? I got you now. So I'm coming in late tomorrow. I'm going to take a nap during the day, and I'm leaving early because as long as you can't fire me because I have a motivating factor.
Well, district courts are very practiced in looking at, is this something that a reasonable jury could decide legitimately is a motivating factor? The fact that someone says something untoward, you have to decide, is this something that is enough to say that we have a motivating factor? It's not any factor. It's a motivating factor.
So under that hypothetical, the employee could prevail.
Well, at least get to the jury, and then the jury would decide, does that really have anything to do with what happened here?
No.
That's what we're saying should happen.
The jury would decide, is that a motivating factor?
That's correct.
According to your analysis, right?
Yes. Yes. And in this case, we have so much evidence that points to this being a motive. This is not where we have some statement that's unconnected. Within 48 days, from Mr. Torsha calling her in and telling her, I don't want you wearing a dress to and from work. I don't want you talking to other employees about your gender identity. And even though she was told that she should.
Well, actually what he said is, I don't want you bringing it up, but if other people bring it up, yes, discuss it.
True, but okay. if we look at...
He just says, I don't want everybody talking about whatever their sexuality is, but if they bring it up and ask questions about it, you then discuss it.
Right, so she's restricted from having these conversations unless technically they bring it up. If we looked at this as a case of, you know, religious discrimination, we said, I don't want you talking about your religion. At what point do we say, yeah, the employer is just, you know, has nothing to do with religion, has nothing to do with gender identity?
I'm looking at the district court order, and he deals with mixed motive in a footnote 4, and he says he acknowledges you raise it, but he says plaintiff does not explain why this action is a mixed motive case and why it applies here. Mixed motive, the employer was motivated by legitimate and discriminatory motives. And then he says, you bear the burden to show the mixed motive. Is that correct? That is, the plaintiff bears the burden. If we go to this new formulation, you have the burden.
The plaintiff has the burden on that point.
And then he says, this is footnote 4, he says, even if the court applied it, you failed to show conform to gender stereotypes was a motivating factor that drove Credit Nation to terminate her. Plaintiff was terminated for sleeping on the job. That was the event that resulted. It happened on a Friday, and she was terminated on Monday. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, but your theory is that they were just watching her with scrutiny to find her to mess up about something so they could fire her.
Yes, and the district court should not make a finding of fact on that point.
Whether he wrote enough about it or not, he did address it and said you'd failed to carry your burden of proof.
He did say that.
Okay. But
when you look at all of the evidence, that's the question that this court needs to address.
Okay. Let me ask you about the timeline. I was confused. She wrote the Atlanta Journal saying my employer's been great, and that was like on November 9th. It was about 30 days before she was fired or whenever. She did write the paper saying they've been great.
Atlanta Journal Constitution.
Okay. And during December, they did give her, she only had a week of accrued leave. She'd only been there a year and a half. They gave her an extra week of paid leave to deal with the surgery and various matters.
Yes.
And that was in late December before they fired her in January.
That's correct.
Okay. And then they fired some other employee for sleeping on the job a couple of months after they fired her.
We don't really know. It's not clear in the record exactly what happened.
You filed a motion to put in Lance Taylor's termination letter.
Which was denied.
Have we ruled on that motion?
Yes, it was denied.
It was denied.
It was denied.
Okay, so that's not in the record.
Right.
I thought somebody said...
There was a reference in a deposition to someone who had been sleeping on the job and had been fired, but we don't know what their record was. We don't know whether they're virtually identical.
But they did fire somebody for sleeping on the job about 2 months after she was fired.
No, I think it was a year later.
A year later?
I believe it was a year.
Okay. And when did this defendant first know about the plaintiff's claims?
She told them when she was terminated that she was planning on bringing a claim.
And did she say that?
She said it. There's affidavits in the record to that effect.
Okay. All right. But the reality is it was a year later before she went to the EEOC.
She had gone to the EEOC immediately the same day that she was terminated, but unfortunately the EEOC did not take her claim.
They said you can't sue for this.
You can't. We don't protect this issue.
Okay. And then she went back. When and they finally
approximately a year after that,
okay.
And she was again told, "You can't bring this claim." And then she heard something else on the radio or on TV, and went back 4 months later, and was told, "You can file the claim."
And the claim was filed with the EEOC outside the 180 days.
Correct.
But the district court did allow equitable tolling and move that and said, "No, we're not going to bother with that."
That's correct.
Saying you got equitable tolling for a year and we'll construe it as a timely file claim.
Yes.
And that issue's not on appeal.
Correct.
Okay.
I see my time is up.
No, but you were answering the questions. Thank you. Very helpful. For Credit Nation.
Good morning.
Cilello.
Mr. Cilello. Yes, Mark Cilello. May it please the court, I'm Mark Cilello, and I'm here for Credit Nation appellee. Let me start by saying this is not a mixed motive case. Jennifer Chavez did not bring this up as a mixed motive case. She did not respond to our motion for summary judgment as if it was a mixed motive case. She dealt with it as if it was a pretext case. It wasn't until after Magistrate Judge Fuller issued his report and recommendation that she responded with her Rule 72 objection, stating that this should have been analyzed under the mixed motive framework. Regardless, she didn't present enough evidence to survive a summary judgment under any standard. Remanding it wouldn't do anything because both Magistrate Judge Fuller and Judge Duffy looked at it under both the pretext framework and under a mixed motive framework and found that under either standard, she didn't present enough evidence to survive summary judgment.
The district court evaluated the claim under a mixed motive context?
The district court analyzed this under a pretext motive under McDonnell Douglas, but as Judge Hall correctly pointed out a few minutes ago, Judge Duffy did look at this briefly as a mixed motive and said, even under that analysis, this case wouldn't survive summary judgment.
Why wouldn't it survive summary judgment under mixed motive analysis if what's contemplated by mixed motive is you've got a valid reason for firing me, however, we also have evidence that you're discriminating against me based upon a prohibited classification?
Well, I would submit that Credit Nation did not fire Ms. Chavez for sex discrimination, for being transgender, for anything that's protected by Title 42.
Well, I understand that, but her claim is that I was fired because of transgender discrimination.
She
right?
was not. She was fired for sleeping on the clock.
I understand that.
I know, but we know that was the articular reason. She says her evidence shows there was another motive, too. That may well have been one motive, but there's enough evidence to show there's another motive. So you need to address her other evidence as to the other motive.
Okay.
She's
well,
saying it's dual motives here.
Right.
They were looking for me to mess up because they wanted to get rid of me, and that's pretty clear. So you need to address the evidence.
Sure. Absolutely. Okay. Her evidence is brought forth such that she said Mr. Torsha wouldn't allow her to wear a dress and heels to work. That's not the case. She was wearing a dress and heels in the shop. She was exposing herself to danger. She was wearing heels instead of a non-slippery rubber boot. There's sharp metal, there's chemicals, heat, all sorts of things. It's just not an appropriate forum.
But I thought her evidence was what he was telling her, I understand, about at work.
Sure.
I thought part of her claim was she construed what he said at work, that I can't even come to work that way and then change out my uniform.
No, she may have construed it that way, but that's not what the evidence shows.
Well, isn't that for the jury to decide? Isn't that a factual issue for the jury? If in fact Congress permits a Title VII plaintiff to prevail under a mixed motive analysis, in other words, you've got valid reasons to terminate me. However, if I've got evidence of discrimination, I can still prevail on my Title VII claim.
Well, I think it needs to be a reasonable inference that a jury can draw from, and the only evidence she has is her subjective thought on this issue. There's consistent testimony from numerous Credit Nation employees, not just Mr. Torsha, but from Ms. Weston as well.
Well, she's got this comment from her supervisor, you know, about her dress, and then there's this email from Credit Nation's attorney, which she says demonstrates that Credit Nation subjected her to additional scrutiny. She's got a coworker statement that she was run out of Credit Nation because of her transgender status. She's got some evidence. You know, I might not think it's enough, but a jury might think it's enough.
Okay, well, we don't think that a reasonable jury could find that. Judge Fuller didn't find that. And Judge Duffy didn't find that either after mm-hmm. analyzing the evidence.
I guess that's why we're here.
Right.
Could a reasonable jury consider her testimony and her evidence and find that her gender status was a motivating factor. If I were a member of Congress, I'm not sure I would word the statute that way, but that's not my – Congress says as long as you can establish the way I read subsection M, if it's a motivating factor, it doesn't have to be the motivating factor.
Right.
They should have said the motivating factor, but they didn't say the motivating factor. They said a motivating factor. And if that's what Congress wants to give people who are subject to these classifications, then why shouldn't she have her case taken to a jury and let a jury decide rather than have the court decide?
Well, I think as you pointed out earlier, that would essentially give employees carte blanche to do whatever they wanted.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I don't think that is appropriate, but Congress has decided that's appropriate because of the way they worded the statute.
That's true. Congress did decide that it was appropriate, but every other circuit that has interpreted this has added the word substantial to it. So it's not just simply a motivating factor. They've added substantial motivating factor. It can't just be a factor amongst many. It needs to be essentially the predominant reason why the employee was terminated.
So if we accept Chavez's argument, then we should do what the other circuits did and add the word substantial to a motivating factor.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And what the other circuits have done, the only circuit that has essentially put aside the McDonnell-Douglas pretext framework was the Sixth Circuit. All the other circuits that have addressed this issue, whether it be the Fourth, the Fifth, the Ninth, they've all said that the plaintiff essentially picks her poison. She chooses the route that she's going to prosecute her claim. She chooses pretext or she chooses motivating factor. And Ms. Chavez chose pretext, so she should continue down that road.
When she made the objection to the M&R, R&R, did y'all come back? I don't know what you did in the district court and say she didn't raise that timely?
Yes.
Your response to her objections, think about my question. You say she came in for the first time raised mixed motive. Did you then respond that's the first time she's raised it?
I don't think that we did. She raised it. In her response to the motion for summary judgment in passing. She didn't cite Desert Palace. She mentioned E2M briefly. She didn't analyze it. She didn't produce any sort of cases on that.
Okay. The other circuits besides the six, when they allow mixed motive, do they still do legitimate reason and then on pretext say you can survive pretext if you show a dual motive, or did they discard McDonnell Douglas and just go to mixed motive?
The only circuit that has discarded McDonnell Douglas at the summary judgment phase when a plaintiff comes forward with circumstantial evidence of a mixed motive is the Sixth Circuit.
Okay.
That's
the only. What do the others do? How do the others analyze it?
Okay. Let's see. Well, the Fifth Circuit has an integrated approach. If the plaintiff demonstrates a prima facie case, the defendant articulates a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason. The plaintiff then offers sufficient evidence of a material fact that either the defendant's reason is not true but is a mere pretext, or that while true, it is but one of the reasons for the conduct, and the other motivating, and there are other motivating factors. Mm-hmm. The Fourth Circuit, Ninth Circuit, and D.C. circuits all essentially say that the plaintiff needs to simply choose. She chooses, and then the Third Circuit, Tenth Circuit, and First Circuits didn't really address this issue. This type of issue has come up before the courts pretty often, where there's not enough evidence under either framework, and the plaintiff chooses to go with a mixed motive standard, and the court refuses to address the issue. This court has done it three times in unreported decisions, in Bernstein versus MTEL, in Lewis versus MARTA, and in the EEOC versus TRC Corp.
Well, what did we do in Pennington versus City of Huntsville? Are you familiar with that case?
No, I'm not, Your Honor.
All right.
Well, whether we do it as discarding McDonnell Douglas or under the pretext and looking whether there's substantial evidence of another motive, okay. What do you do with the fact that you got Mr. Torsher's comments? He says, as she just argued, I don't want you talking about in this workplace unless somebody asks about it, what you're doing. We got the email, actually the email by the attorney, the additional scrutiny thing is that she's complained about the bathroom and the email just says, you need to go make sure you document whatever happens here. She says she was not allowed to use the female bathroom that the customers use, and that was another part of her evidence. Can you help me with
absolutely
whether she was not allowed to use the female bathroom?
Absolutely. There is overwhelming evidence in the record. It's uncontroverted that there were two restrooms. There was a technician restroom, and there was a restroom for customer usage. Ms. Chavez, presenting as a male, used the technician restroom. When she started presenting as a female, she asked if she wanted to use the other restroom, and her claim was, well, Jennifer Batabuli gets to use this restroom. Why shouldn't I?
Who?
And Jennifer Batabuli, who was, she was administrative personnel. She didn't have, you know, grease and all the technician stuff. And the response is, well, there are two men and two women that use that restroom in the front of the house. This has nothing to do with gender. This has everything to do with cleanliness. And so as a technician, regardless of how you present, you need to use the technician restroom.
Do they have any other female technicians besides the plaintiff here?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
And appellant actually testified that the real reason she didn't want to use that bathroom was when she started presenting as a female and wearing a dress and heels to and from work, which she actually did, she didn't want to get them dirty. The technician restroom had grease and grime on the walls and floors.
These all seem to me to be arguments to be made to a jury. I mean, she didn't have to prove her case beyond a reasonable doubt. She's got evidence that her employer said she was the best mechanic in the shop. And then they found out she was a transgender and everything changed. And Torcia told her she could not wear too feminine attire coming to or leaving work. She's got a lot of little things that can add up that a reasonable jury could say, you know what? Her transgender status was a motivating factor for her termination. What's wrong with that analysis?
Your Honor, I suppose that could be the case. Our position is simply that she didn't present enough evidence to raise a genuine issue of material fact.
Mm-hmm.
That's simply our position on this.
Okay.
Can you help me with the other employee who was fired for sleeping on at work? Do we have record evidence of when that occurred? I know it was Lance Taylor. Do we know when that happened? Did anybody in the deposition?
I think that was Cindy Weston testified to that. I don't remember the exact date. I think it was June of 2010.
That would have been after the plaintiff.
Yes,
was
it was. Fired. It was after. It was after Ms. Chavez
was
terminated.
You think it's in Weston's deposition?
It's in Weston's deposition for sure. I don't remember the exact date, but I think it was.
And do we know how long that employee had worked there who was fired?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
No.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Weiss.
Credit Nation's evidence of some good treatment is not enough to rebut poor treatment, and that is taught to us by the Price Waterhouse case. With regard to the bathroom, it is a de facto male restroom. At the meeting with Mr. Torsha, they discussed using the separate restroom as an accommodation for her gender transition, and that is in the record.
There are two bathrooms, right?
Two bathrooms.
All right.
Correct.
And there's one that's up front, that's the customer bathroom.
Correct.
And then there's one that the technicians use that's a unisex bathroom.
They're both unisex to some extent.
Okay.
But the second one was the one used by all the female personnel in the place. This issue about being dirty is not an issue.
Were there any female technicians with the grease and the dirty
No clothes? Female technicians.
Okay, so they say, I'm not saying this right. I'm just trying to understand
sure.
the evidence.
Absolutely.
They say, we have the technicians use that because we have extra whatever they, some
it
kind of
It is demonstrated factually to be wrong. Because in Volume 2, Tab 64, Cindy Weston testified, when we met with Mr. Torsha, we let her use this customer restroom as an accommodation. So that argument about this is a dirty bathroom, this is a clean bathroom.
So they then let her do it, but then they stopped letting her do it?
Correct.
Okay.
They gave her the key.
They first let her use the customer.
Correct.
And then were there complaints by coworkers, and they stopped letting her use it?
They told her, you can no longer use this restroom.
Why?
Because coworkers complaining about special treatment. She had been opposing some gender-based harassment that she was getting from her coworkers. She was actually written up for opposing that on December 15th. And then on December 30th, they said to her, you can no longer use this customer restroom.
She was written up for what?
She had received some harassment from coworkers and had said to them, you know, stop harassing me, don't mess with me, you know, I can call the vice president who told me. You know, and so she was actually written up as causing a disruption for saying that.
So she was written up for what they perceived to be causing a disruption.
Correct.
Okay.
And then apparently for that reason.
What actually happened? I thought they got shouting and it was language and so forth that
there were two incidents.
She allegedly used and
right. She allegedly used an expletive.
Okay.
She, you know, I don't know actually, you know, what, but this is an issue for the jury. What exactly happened here? Was she written up for opposing gender-based harassment? And then did they, as a result, say to her, you can no longer use this bathroom because it's causing a disruption, you're getting special treatment, people don't like it.
So if I understand your argument, we're talking about all these facts. This is fact-finding that ought to be left to the jury. Is that what you're essentially arguing, bottom line?
That's correct, Your Honor, that, you know, Credit Nation has failed to issue or to show uncontroverted evidence supporting the rationale. We've pointed to both direct and indirect evidence showing that there is sufficient evidence to raise the discriminatory motive. Thank you.
Thank you. The next case